If you'd like to receive this podcast early and without ads, consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Listeners to this show can receive 25% off the membership price. In addition to an ad-free listening experience and early access, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows via our private member feed, enhanced show notes for selected podcasts, and an invitation to join the DSR Slack community. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code NOJOKE to receive 25% off. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code NOJOKE. This offer is limited and will expire on Saturday, April 6th, so act now. And thank you very much for your support.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm David Rothkopf and I'm your host. This is the Mothership, the podcast where it all started, where we talk about the world here at Deep State Radio. And I am joined as ever by the fabulous Rosa Brooks of Georgetown University Law School. How are you today, Rosa?
I'm good. Hi, David.
Good. Well, that's very, you know, sort of a peak as far as you go. Ed Luce of the Financial Times. How are you, Ed?
I'm great. Just sunbathing in this glorious spring sunshine.
Yeah, this is a real English spring day here in Washington. Torrential rain from dawn till dusk. Not dealing with torrential rain, but dealing with other sorts of plagues and disasters is Noga Tarnopolsky, who is a journalist who writes for just about everybody and recently has been on US TV a lot. How are you today, Noga?
Well, I haven't slept in 48 hours because of what is happening where I'm living. So I'm having a drink.
Well, you've come to the right place for a drink. You may have come to the right place to help you sleep, but some people have come to us for just that. What is it about the past 48 hours that are particularly getting to today, Noga?
Well, the situation here feels kind of unfathomable and apocalyptic, and it's mostly there's a feeling that no matter how you twist and turn the facts of the last few days, the last few weeks, there's just no clear way out. There's no imaginable way out right now without things getting even worse. And they are feeling catastrophic. So in the last few days, the Israeli army, as you wrote about today, engaged in two bombings, one of which was successful on Israeli terms. The targeted bombing of an Iranian facility in Damascus, in which a very senior general was killed. The Iranians claim it was their consulate. The Israelis say it was not at all a diplomatic facility, and it's not listed as such. But there are fears that this could provoke an escalation regionally. What for sure is provoking, I don't know if a military escalation, but a disaster, humanly, diplomatically, politically, is the Israeli bombing of seven workers of José Andrés's World Central Kitchen in Gaza, who were en route from their ship to their warehouse carrying essential goods for Gazans. And they were smashed to smithereens by three, not one, three targeted Israeli bombs. And the Israelis have made, in addition to this catastrophe itself, they've made a big mess so far in these 2 days of trying to explain what happened. And it just feels, the situation feels desperate. The prime minister is home in bed today, the Israeli prime minister, lying about his health. Nobody really knows why he underwent surgery over the weekend. his government ministers have spent the day insulting Joe Biden. The prime minister really saved Israel at the start of this war. And it just feels kind of apocalyptic. I don't know how else to say it. It's really, really hard right now. Despite the fragility of Netanyahu's government, to see a way out, because he's interested only in holding on to power. And his worst ministers, the most nutjobby, see in this government their once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to blackmail him to hold on to power. And so all of their differences end up not mattering compared to the power of their desire to hold on to government. And that's Israel in its entirety has been taken hostage by this situation. And I would venture to say that the Palestinians are also hostages to this catastrophic government.
And so there's no truth to the rumor that Netanyahu's surgery involved removing the last of his scruples?
There are so many jokes. And, you know, I don't even know what to say. The avalanche of news is so constant and it's so bad that, you know, a catastrophic report was published about 36 hours ago detailing the Netanyahu's family's plunder of Israeli public funds to build their many private homes. Rebuild, fix the pool, fix the doors, you name it. And it's the kind of report that should be a huge scandal. It's that what came out in this ombudsman report is terrible. It's just the depths of corruption. And no one is even paying attention to it, not because it's unimportant, but because it can't be fathomed what's happening here. And most everyone who I speak to says to me, I say, how are you? They say, I can't breathe.
Wow. Well, in some ways, Israel and the U.S. are growing farther apart. In some ways, we seem to be growing more similar. We endure something quite like that. Maybe, Rosa and Ed, you may have some question or reaction to what Noga just said before I start asking all of you questions. Ed?
Is the anger of Netanyahu's cabinet against Biden, is this because Biden once again has said, I disapprove, thoughts and prayers, but nothing more? Because they could not ask for a better U.S. president if they want to continue on the path they're going.
You know, it's like we're talking about parallel universes. So you're asking me a question from the point of view of a rational person observing reality, thinking that this, I'm putting words in your mouth here, but thinking that this situation is terrible and lamenting the fact that Joe Biden is facilitating this disaster so far. When I speak about his worst ministers or allies, I'm thinking of someone like Bezalel Smotrich, who is a deep and genuine messianic lunatic. He believes God speaks directly to him. He believes that all of the land, I guess, from Jerusalem to Iraq, is his as a representative of the Jews. He really thinks this. So we're talking about, you know, either clinical cases or extremists. I don't really know how to describe this. Former Prime Minister Ehud Barak calls these people the Proud Boy ministers, which I think is not bad. There's another one. Itamar Ben-Gvir, he's been convicted 13 times of terror-related crimes. He's in charge of the police. So we had extreme violence last night here in Jerusalem, directed at peaceful, anti-government, anti-war protesters. I mean, really something terrible. You have the families of Israeli hostages fearful to speak out because they're scared that the government will take revenge against their beloved hostage if they dare say anything. So these kinds of people, they are lashing out at Biden either because they think he should be facilitating the Lord's work and handing the entire West Bank on a silver platter to the Israelis, or because he's become a convenient political cudgel. your guess is as good as mine. I can't analyze these people, but they're coming at it from a parallel universe to ours.
Rosa?
Yeah. You know, one of the last times we spoke to you on this podcast, you said something that surprised me a bit. We've all been extremely critical of Biden and his approach to the conflict and his approach to Israel. And I think we've all tended to see him as much too weak. He's enabling the worst excesses by Netanyahu. And you said, you know, he's actually very popular within Israel. And he's doing a pretty good job in a hard situation. And I think obviously we all also acknowledge that he's in a really tough situation, but feel like, whoa, he could have applied a whole lot more pressure a lot earlier. And I wonder if that has changed either your own assessment of how he's doing and his administration or the degree to which you're hearing popular support for him within Israel at this point.
My assessment of the situation has changed. I think since we last spoke, things have developed. And in one respect, they stayed static in that this war is ongoing. At this point, I think it's very difficult to justify this war. I can't remember when it was that we last spoke. I still think that Joe Biden is in a really difficult situation. When you're president of the United States, you can't really say about a country that's been a cornerstone of your superpower's international policy for the last 50 years, bye guys. It just doesn't work that way. Even if we are right now at a juncture that will prove historically important in terms of a rupture between Israel and the United States, which is absolutely one of the possibilities. We may be at that point now. I wouldn't have said that a month and a half ago. Even if we're there, it's not something that's going to change tomorrow morning. The ties between the countries are deep. Mostly U.S. interests are involved here. I think I said last time we spoke that Netanyahu was beginning to harm U.S. interests. And if U.S. interests in the Middle East are harmed, that means that U.S. global interests are harmed. And I think now, without any shadow of a doubt, the Netanyahu government, in its mishandling of this war, in its lack of any kind of visible horizon, in its irresponsible messaging, in all of these respects, it is clearly harming American interests. I would be very surprised if in the next 2-3 weeks, we don't begin to see the United States responding more explicitly to that.
Interesting. I'd like to ask a question to each, Ed and Rosa, and then circle back to Noga to get her reactions to their responses. But it picks up on what Noga was just talking about. There's a story that broke in the past hour or so from prior to our recording this, saying President Biden is super angry at Benjamin Netanyahu, but he absolutely will not change U.S. policy. Now, I don't know what kind of person in the White House thought leaking that story was a great idea. You know, to say, oh yeah, he's really angry, but he's not doing anything about it. But, you know, we're kind of a long way down the time to be really angry at Bibi Netanyahu road. And yet the United States is resolutely refusing to use its leverage, whatever leverage it may have, if it has any leverage, to change the behavior of this government. And, you know, during the course of that time and the time since Noga was last with us, we've had a Gallup poll that shows the majority of Americans oppose how Israel is handling Gaza. For the first time, you know, and I can remember, it means the majority of Americans do not agree with the policy of the administration on this. That is growing. The president apparently had an iftar last night at the White House, or was having one scheduled, and there were so few outside members of the Islamic community who wanted to attend that they had to change it to be just one from inside the administration. And you know, the one or two who agreed to said, well, I can't go and stay here with this, with, you know, if I'm the only Palestinian voice in the room. Something very dramatic, it seems to me, is happening inside the U.S.-Israel relationship. And the person least inclined to acknowledge it is Joe Biden. But that's just my take. What do you say, Ed?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the first time. I mean, we've had a number of these leaks over a period of months now, with the administration saying Biden's really pissed off this time. You know, to the extent where you expect, if there's two or three more World Food Kitchen type incidents, he will write a Hans Blix style, strongly worded letter.
Pissed off next time.
Really, and like those adjectives will be sharp. Sometimes the generational cliche about Israel is that people over 65, you know, are the Golda Meir. Americans over 65 think of Golda Meir. They think of Israel as David, and the quite rightly at that time, and the region around it as Goliath. And then people sort of in their 40s and 50s, they're a little bit more nuanced about it, because, you know, they probably grew up with Shamir or Begin, as well as with Rabin. But people who are under 30 have grown up with Netanyahu. They've never known an attempt, good faith or otherwise, at a peace process. They've never known Israel to be anything other than Goliath. From what I understand of the opinion polls in the United States, the shifting polls you just mentioned, David, older Americans are now switching their view about this war. It's not just those, below 50. And that is very significant, because that is Biden's cohort. There was a really interesting interview that Isaac Chotiner did with Aaron David Miller, the former administration official, in the last couple of days in The New Yorker, in which he kept pressing Miller. So does Biden care more about Israelis than other people, including Palestinians? And the answer was basically yes. It's like, he's sentimental about Israelis, but people he's not sentimental about, he's not sentimental about. Maybe because Jose Andres is such a beloved figure in Washington, D.C.
And we are sentimental about tapas.
Yeah, we're sentimental about good Spanish cooking, and people who get nominated by Nancy Pelosi for the Nobel Peace Prize, like Jose Andres. So maybe that's the kind of personal connection, in the sort of quirky way of how humans, you know, change their mind, that can change Biden's mind. But I agree with the premise of your question, David. These strongly worded private, you know, frustrations are beyond parody. They're actually harming, not helping, and Biden's ability to influence the situation.
Yeah, Rosa, you know, you and I, we've been talking about Biden's team ever since it arrived. Many of the members of Biden's team we've talked about here are friends of ours who we admire. We think they've done a lot of great things in foreign policy over the course of the past over 3 years. I was talking to somebody else who's a friend of this podcast yesterday. We're having an exchange with them, and they said they appear to be weaklings. There doesn't appear to be anybody strong enough to walk into Biden as theoretically James Baker might have walked into George H.W. Bush and said, okay, this has got to stop. Now, I'm not for the whitewashing of the errors of James Baker or other secretaries of state. Almost all the strong ones had serious weaknesses. And I don't think it's fair to say that these people are ineffective because they've been running a good foreign policy. But they sure collectively seem to be blowing this. And I'm just wondering what your thought is, Rosa.
I'm also feeling very depressed and feeling like it's hard to see any way out of this. But I think, look, I like Joe Biden. You know, I worked for his campaign. I voted for him. I, you know, if he were stone cold dead, I would still vote for him over Donald Trump. And until relatively recently, I would have given him pretty high grades on foreign policy and domestic policy. I think he's overall done a good job, and in many ways a better job than I think I or many of us expected. But his response to this has been catastrophically awful and disappointing and devastating. And honestly, I see it as consistent with the fact that he's running again. Right. I mean, and the fact that no one apparently had the guts to say to him, Joe, you can't run again. You know, you're going to hurt the party. You're going to hurt our chances against Donald Trump. It's clear that at this point he's a drag on his own party. It's clear that on Gaza and Israel, his views are now out of line, not only with the left of the Democratic Party, but with the mainstream of the Democratic Party. You know, he's losing the moderates. He's losing the centrists within his own party. And no one seems willing or able to say to him, I don't know whether it's ego or whether it's sheer stubbornness or obtuseness on this issue. This is getting in the way, you know, as I said, I actually think it's similar to running again, that choice to run again. You know, is it ego? Is it obtuseness and refusal to see reality? Is it both? Probably a little bit of both. I don't know, right? If all of his top people, you know, if Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken walked into his office together with every senior aide, you know, Lloyd Austin, and said, Mr. President, we are all strongly opposed to this, would it change his mind? I don't think so, because I think he sort of heard that. I think my sense is that they've been saying it, albeit politely. If they all walked in and said, Mr. President, we're resigning tomorrow if you don't change, would that make a difference? Maybe. Do I think any of them are going to do that? No. I think if you look at, if you want my 5-cent pop psych analysis, you know, Biden has been surrounding himself with good, dutiful sons. You know, he's, and that's what he got, right? He got loving, supportive sons. And I can't see them actually doing that, frankly. Partly, it's the very things that are good about those people, you know, that they're good, honest, kind people makes them the people who I think are very unlikely to feel like they have it in them to go and say, Mr. President, change or we're out of here, or we will publicly criticize you. I don't think they have it in them. So I don't see any change. And it's just really awful. I think there's a substantial chance that this becomes the thing that ends up losing the Democrats the election in 2020, because you don't have to have people vote against Biden. You just have to have just enough people in a close election as it will be to stay home. And I think that's, at the moment, you know, barring some really stunning new developments, that's what it's looking like to me.
Can I interrupt? I mean, I get the distinct impression Kamala Harris is aware of this, and she would have a different impact, not if she threatened to resign, but if she went into the Oval Office and made it very clear this is self-harming.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, there's one more indicator of this, Noga, before I get your response to what Ed and Rosa just said. And it's the indicator I would be least likely to use to gain insight into U.S. foreign policy. And that's Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump is, he's fundamentally evil. You know, he's as deformed a character as we've ever seen in American politics. But he was having a conversation about this, and his response, you know, to his Israeli interlocutor was, "You guys have got to wrap this thing up." Now, the reason he said that was not because he cares about anybody in Gaza, because he doesn't. It's not because he cares about anybody in Israel, because he doesn't. It's because he's running for re-election. It's an existential issue for him, because otherwise he's going to get thrown in the slammer. And he knows he has to cleave tight to Israel. And he does not, he thinks that being supportive of Israel is a political loser, you know, and I don't rate Trump's judgment on almost anything, but on that particular thing, it's clear that he, like Rosa Brooks, and they're often traveling in lockstep together, see the support for Israel as a political loser now in the United States. Anyway, what's your reaction to that, sitting from an Israeli perspective?
I can't speak for an Israeli perspective, but I'm curious from the three of you, what do you wish Joe Biden had done? Let's take this period of time, 6 months, right? We're speaking in early April. This started on October 7th. What in your minds should Joe Biden have done during these 6 months?
Can I answer that?
Yeah, absolutely.
He did the right thing in the beginning, which is to say, look, we're with you. This is an absolutely execrable, bestial Hamas attack on Israel, and we are with you. And so he started off the right way, which is to leave no doubt, correct me if I'm wrong, but leave no doubt in the Israeli public mind that all the sympathy is with Israel, that the perpetrators of this barbarism should be tracked down and eliminated. Then he made the mistake of thinking he had to keep doing that. When Netanyahu refused to have a day after plan, refused to include the Palestinian Authority, refused to do targeted, pinpointed bombing, continued to receive 2,000-pound bombs, including this week, from the United States, only had very light pinprick Treasury sanctions on the continued expansion of settlements in the West Bank, and so on and so forth, all of which implicitly lays out what Biden could have been doing since then. Now, he abstained at the United Nations, the US abstained at the United Nations the other day. There could have been a US-sponsored resolution, or at least sort of cooperation with other countries on a resolution. There are so many things he could have done that would not be to abandon Israel. There would never be any question of supporting the Temple Dome and Israel's ability to, defend itself. But this offensive sort of 2,000-pound bomb approach to Gaza has been going on for almost 6 months. And a lot of it's with American munitions, which makes America complicit. And I think Biden does bear, odd though it sounds, in the case of such a decent man, he does have blood on his hands.
Yeah, let me jump in here, if that's okay with you, Rosa, because I agree with that. But just to amplify it a little bit, and I hate the people who are always, I told you so. So you can just draw your own conclusions. I wrote a column the day after October 7th, and I said, don't give Bibi Netanyahu a blank check. And I think Ed was right. In the first 24 hours, the expression of compassion from the president of the United States was exactly what was called for, because the relationship... Pardon me?
Maybe not hugging Netanyahu, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the bear hug was too much. And I think realizing that Netanyahu was going to serially reject every request of the United States, serially make a show of rejecting every request, entreaty, or demand of the United States, and systematically undermine U.S. interests in the region while serially violating international law without responding to it, was bad. The fact is, though, that the spokesperson of the National Security Council has defended Netanyahu up to and through yesterday with regard to the World Central Kitchen. And this is ridiculous. And it's offensive to people. And, we could have shown support for the people of Israel while suspending the sale of offensive military weapons weeks or months ago, saying, no, we're not doing this anymore until there's a day after plan, until there is a plan to, accept a Palestinian leadership, until you accept a two-state solution, until the humanitarian issues are taken care of. You can prioritize any of those things and use the leverage that we've got. Would that have stopped Netanyahu? Maybe it wouldn't have. But it would have stopped the bleeding in U.S. foreign policy and the fact that right now Joe Biden is as associated with 33,000 deaths in Gaza, 70,000 injuries in Gaza, 1 million people at risk of imminent famine in Gaza. And that's the problem here. Right now, that looks like a joint undertaking of Benjamin Netanyahu and Joe Biden. And whatever Biden could have done to stop it from looking like that, he should have done. Anyway, Rosa, do you want to say one more thing before?
Well, just to add a couple of things. I mean, right. The U.S. could stop protecting Israel and the U.N. I completely take your point that some of the potential leverage points the U.S. has with Israel would potentially hurt the U.S.'s own interests if we followed through. For instance, we could say, well, we're not going to position carriers in the region, which is a way of deterring more widespread conflict. We could say, well, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to basically signal to others in the region that we don't really care anymore what happens. Well, that would be really bad for us too, right? I mean, and so that's an empty form of leverage. We're not going to use it because it would hurt us as much as it would potentially be a something that would make Netanyahu take pause. So no question. I mean, there are some things there that might have an impact on Netanyahu's decision making, but that we can't afford to threaten or carry through on. Therefore, we can't even credibly threaten. But there obviously are things that we can credibly threaten to do. And I think that's, David's point. I completely agree. It might not have made a difference, right? Maybe it wouldn't make a difference in the ultimate outcome. But from a sort of American perspective, thinking also ahead to the election, there's a difference between being able to stop something and being actively complicit in carrying it on. And I think Biden has gotten to the point, past the point where he's made the U.S. actively complicit. I have a question for you again, if I can turn it back around. I look at this from the outside, and it is reminiscent of the 9/11 attacks on the U.S., where we took something that was devastating. It was appalling. It was just shocking and horrific. And we treated it as an existential threat. And we then overreacted in a zillion ways that were devastating both to others around the world, including innocent civilian populations, and ultimately very destructive to our own interests. My sense from the outside is that the Hamas attacks on October 7th were not dissimilar, that they were devastating, they were horrific, they were brutal, they were awful, but not an existential threat to Israel. And that certainly after the initial Israeli military response, that Hamas was no longer in a position, I don't know what moment you would say, was it after week one, after week four, after week six, I don't know. But somewhere along the line, the ability of Hamas in a sort of immediate way to carry out attacks on a similar scale and cause similar harm to Israeli security, to Israeli lives, was clearly greatly diminished. That Hamas could continue to do what it had done on and off for years, which is smaller scale attacks, and that's bad. It's horrible, and it's every death is horrible. But there's no existential threat coming from Hamas at this point. It seems from the outside as though Israel is now at the point under Netanyahu's leadership, if you can call it that, where Israel is increasingly in existential danger because of its own actions, have made it so vulnerable in terms of isolating it internationally, in terms of turning so many friends into critics, in terms of creating a situation where the U.S. clearly is seriously questioning whether it's in its interest any longer to play that role of protector, even protector, much less supplier. And is that just way off base from the perspective of sensible Israelis, or does that seem like the right analysis?
So one second, I'd like to go to Noga and get her answer on that. This is the point of the show where we say to everybody who's not a member, thanks for listening. And to listen to the whole broadcast, you have to become a member. Go to thedsrnetwork.com, click on membership. Why do we ask you to do this? Well, because it helps us to be able to do this, to pay salaries, to be able to run this tiny media company. I don't think we can make it any tinier to save you money. So, please accept our honest assertion that this is a low, low price that couldn't really be any lower. And support us. Go become a member. But for those of you who are not members, right now we have to say bye-bye. And for those of you who are members, we say stand by.